Welcome to Chew the Fat Pad. This is a podcast where we talk to clinicians around the world who've got interesting thoughts on interesting topics that we all need to know about. And today I am very pleased to have Alex Newman on the show with me again. I have actually interviewed Alex before, but we had an audio problem and I couldn't share that interview. So I'm really pleased that Alex agreed to come back. We've just been saying, excellent speaker with lots of interesting thoughts on important topics. So thank you, Alex. Would you mind giving us a little intro into where you're from so that your patients can understand where to get hold of you, for example?
Yeah. For sure. I mean, thank you for having me on the podcast again, Tim. My name is Dr. Alex Newman, but a lot of my patients call me Dr. Alex. I am a medical director, general practitioner working in Montreal and medical director of Medulis Clinic there. And I practice there pretty much part-time right now. I'm still working at a lot of different sort of clinics, but that's going to be my sort of main spot for the next coming years. So thanks for having me on.
Great. And I was lucky enough to meet Alex when we're in Portugal. We put out an Instagram story and I'll never forget, Alex was like, you guys are in Portugal? And we ended up having a drink together in the central square, which is great. It's wonderful meeting clinicians like this. And now we get to collaborate on a podcast, which is amazing.
Exactly. Absolutely random. I hope you and Miranda are still doing very well, but let's jump right into the topic. And I think at the last topic that we actually spoke about was about how to become or how to be a more ethical injector. And I think this topic really ties into that as well. And I'm going to let you announce it, actually, Tim. So go ahead.
So it's a really hot topic. And I know we all have questions about this, because when it comes up on social media and you're scrolling down and you see what to our eye is quite a bizarre result, and then there's like 20,000 likes on the picture, it really gets you thinking about what's going on and what are we going to do when our patients come and ask for this bizarre looking result, and how do we make our way through this while still being ethical, safe injectors and giving people good advice and not kind of antagonizing people who do this as well. But I thought it was a really hot topic and definitely worth unpacking. So tell me a little bit about what triggered you to want to talk about this podcast. What are your feelings around it?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of tied into our last conversation, but one of the reasons why is because I do get once in a while patients coming and asking for a certain type of trend. I'm sure you've had your patients as well, and I'm sure clinicians and injectors all over the world are also, you know, faced with this sort of issue. Well, I don't necessarily call it an issue. It's just something new that we see more and more frequently in my practice and probably in your practice as well. Of course, with the growth and sort of the explosion of social media, TikTok, Instagram, Reels, short form videos, I mean, more and more creators are trying to push out more creative content, right? Things that are appealing to the eye. And unfortunately, in medical aesthetics, things that are more appealing to the eye generally generate more views, more likes, more comments, more attention, essentially. It's more attention grabbing. So as a clinician, you're trying to find your part and your role into all of that. And should you be following the trend? Should you not follow the trend? Should you, you know, only do a part of that trend? Like, who knows, right? This is why we're having this conversation. So I think it was important to mention it to other clinicians as well.
Yeah. So this would be the case of, so picture something that's slightly controversial. In fact, I'll start with the story. The first time I ever realized about this dynamic was a long time ago, and it was with lip tenting. And there was a Russian doctor, I don't remember the exact name, but it was something like Dr. Bazooka. So kind of demanded, like quite a powerful, attention-grabbing name. And then there were these vertical injections that were going right through the top of the lip, and then blood was like pouring all down both sides of the mouth, as blood pouring everywhere, as you can imagine it would be if you went straight through the superior labial artery. And this story had, or video had, like thousands of people liking and commenting on it. And some people were obviously being negative and some people being positive. But it suddenly hit me then, like, wow, this is if you go all out for attention, even if it's something that's actually quite terrifying, because of the nature of social media and the algorithm, a lot of people get to see it. And enough of those people actually think there's something cool about it, which, you know, if you're not of that mindset, it's hard to understand. But it does something about that particular story that I think to some patients represented some sort of adventure or kind of danger in a good way, something exciting. And before you know it, like, everyone thinks that's the way that you do lips, which it really isn't.
In a, in a way, it kind of normalizes things as well, right? The more you see of it on your phone, or the more you see it even in the streets, the more you're going to think, this is probably normal. This is probably what lip results are what all injectors are creating, which is definitely not the case if you really do a deep dive and take a look at all the different types of lip results that you can deliver. So, I mean, that's one example of the lip results. But, you know, we were talking about some other trends that are a little bit more popular as well, like the fox eye trend, for example, right? Sometimes mm-hmm. a lot of it is from the beauty industry, right? A lot of these sort of trends come from TikTok, makeup, and then it sort of slowly shifts more towards the field of medical aesthetics. The difference is that I would say beauty makeup is generally overall harmless if the products that you're using are overall safe. But when you start going more into the field of medical aesthetics, well, there's a lot other things that you need to take into account, things like risks, side effects, complications, right? So these are some things that a lot of these trends, I would say, seldom mention or tend to mention not as often as showing the result, right? So that's what you generally see on social media.
Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting idea as well, the idea of normalization. I see it particularly with sort of some side effects that I would, in terms of bruising, for example, around lips. You see occasionally a reel that's posted that shows you the process of someone having a lip procedure, and sometimes it's mild bruising, but sometimes it's really extreme bruising, and the message is sort of trust the process. Now I really like that idea of being honest about what patients should expect, but the other side of it is, if you're saying expect this rather extreme amount of bruising and side effects that you can easily get away with, you're actually normalizing something that's actually on the far end of the bell curve. And the patients don't know that. They just think, oh right, if you have your lips done, you end up with huge swelling and bruising, which sometimes is true, but it doesn't have to always be true.
And exactly,
I think we have to somehow get that message out.
I mean, I feel as if, like, back to your conversation more about the bell curve, I mean, there's probably a certain amount of patients that are going to get bruising regardless of sort of what technique you're going to be using, whether it's cannula or needle. There's always a slight risk of having a bruise, but the more you play with tissue, the more you move your needle in and out of the lip tissue, the more you're going to create some bruising. That's what creates these sort of heightened, sort of like that really high vertical lip injection that gives you even more height. I mean, there's a certain limit of how much height you can actually give, right? The red of the lip is only so high, and at some point you're going to start flipping out the inner mucosa actually of the lip, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, everybody has a certain type of lip. You can't just recreate any sort of lip, even if you wanted to, right? So there's boundaries to some of these trends that even us as clinicians, we can even perform.
Yeah, I think that's another really interesting point, because I think part of the implication when you see these really extreme results, if you think about what's really going on, it's a demonstration of power. Like, look what I can do with filler. And obviously, if you're on our side of the fence, you understand that picture has been, it's the perfect angle with the perfect lighting and the perfect aged client. And you're seeing her the snapshot just after it's done, and you don't get to see it in 2 weeks' time or 3 weeks' time when she's, somewhere else. And you don't get to see it in 3D either. So there's something around preparing, realizing that what they're essentially doing, and no one's not trying to do this, but we're all trying to demonstrate our capabilities. But when it's extreme, I think patients get a distorted view of what's actually possible, which is baked into the what social media rewards. It rewards things that look superlative, even if they're not truthful.
Exactly. The more outside of the norm that you are, like the more mundane things are, the less social media is going to grab onto it and focus onto it, essentially. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So tell us a little bit about, I'm interested in how you have handled this so far. If you've ever had a patient coming in, asking for something that's actually on the far end of the bell curve on Instagram and not really either the type of treatment you would do or even perhaps something that you think is actually possible to actually achieve in a sustainable way. How do you handle those patients?
Well, thankfully, a lot of the patients that go and consult me already, they sort of know the style. I mean, they can see my page. It's sort of a very, it's nothing overblown, nothing like too much when it comes to my work anyway. So a lot of the times my patients are coming in with their phone. They'll be like, hey, I saw this online. What do you think about it? They won't necessarily be like, I want it, right? Which is a whole completely different story. But when they are sort of asked for your opinion, well, I pretty much give them my own opinion. Which is essentially a trend is a short it's a temporary thing where a lot of people are grabbing attention for one specific type of look. Like they're going for that look, right? And we're going to go to some other examples later in the podcast. But, you know, things like the fox eye, things like the, I mean, you mentioned sometimes the pixie nose, things like that. Like trends are something that are generally short lasting. The issue mm-hmm. with a lot of the short lasting treatments is that, well, the treatments that we offer, some of them are long lasting, right? Like fillers, for example, right? A lot of them we're saying, you know, most of the times we're saying 6 to 12 months. But as we know now, fillers are lasting sometimes years, right? They can have long lasting effects on some of these patients when something you wanted might have been just very short term, right? So those are some of the reasons why I explain to patients, well, trends is a very short term thing. You should be looking more in the long term when it comes to medical aesthetics, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of patients, just by giving them that information or explaining even some of the risks of these certain types of trends, depending on what they are, a lot of them will just not necessarily back away, but be like, you know what, let me just think about it, see what I think about it, and I'll get back to you. Perfect, no problem. I mean, you're more than welcome to take your time necessary to see what I sort of feel about the treatment. I mean, I'm very blunt with my patients in the sense where I explain to them pretty much all the risks, all the complications based on the trend and what treatments can create those results. So to give an example, like let's say the fox eye look, right? Based on makeup initially, but a lot of the, some injectors in the US, for example, are using threads, right? Threads, sometimes even surgeries to sort of create that lifted eyebrow at the corner of the lateral eyebrow right here. So some of these treatments aren't even available in Canada. Like I can't even, there's only one thread that's currently Health Canada approved, and I can't even do that thread to even do it, to be honest with you. So I'm not allowed to do it. I won't do it. I mean, by all means, if you want to get that treatment, you're more than welcome to. It's just that you have to be aware about the risks and complications related to it, right? And maybe some of these risks and complications aren't worth it, knowing that it's going to be a short lasting thing. Maybe in 6 months, you might not like it, right? Because it's not the new hip thing that's out there. I'm not the other judge to say, you know what, the fox eye looks good or not good, right? That's not necessarily my job. I'm sure some people think that the fox eye trend looks amazing, right? Others might think it doesn't look that great. But just in overall normalcy as an aesthetic injector, you're trying to stay within that, is essentially what you mean, like that bell curve of normalcy, right? You're not trying to completely transform someone's face. And that's what we call alienization, right? You're no longer looking human at some points with, if you keep on following some of these trends and going to the extreme. So that's my sort of approach to it, is just explain to the patient, give them the information. There are certain trends that honestly I won't even touch, just based that I don't think that the risk just don't align enough, or the benefits aren't there related to the risk. So sometimes I'll just pretty much say, you know what, this is not for me. Maybe for some injector they might be able to do it, but it's not something that I necessarily want to be involved with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's similar wording to that I like, which is to try and tread the line where you have your own boundaries, but you're not being judgmental. I don't think it helps anyone if you condemn them for wanting it. In fact, you lose influence as soon as you become the judge of their request rather than a guide. I tell you what, I've always been quite interested in is like, why, because it blows my mind sometimes. You'll see something which to my mind looks really bizarre, and the number of people who really like it, I mean, at least literally the physical likes on the post. What do you think is going on with why it appeals to people?
I think there's a part of wanting to fit in, right? There's a part of, you know, one of my colleagues got the treatment. She got all those likes. So in your mind, you're saying, well, you know what? Maybe a lot of people actually like it. I should probably do it because it probably will look good on me, right? That's a simple way of looking at it. You know, the fear of missing out, right? Fear of missing out might be another reason why some people might want to follow these trends. Maybe even status symbol, right? Maybe it's a sign to say, you know what, I got medical aesthetics done. I went to see this person who is renowned on Instagram, has this many followers. This is the results that she's doing. It's super trendy. You know, it makes it so that you want to fit into a certain type of community as well. There's personally nothing wrong with that. I think it's a great thing that there's community around medical aesthetics. It's just that when you go more towards the extremes of the bell curve, that's when you're starting to slowly see, like, and you can even see it in some of the posts and the comments online, it gets more and more negative, right? At first, it might be, you know, maybe 1 in 10 people are going to post a negative thing about it. And then the more extreme it gets, the more you're going to see well, it's actually quite negative, right? I mean, I know this myself because I sometimes comment on these pages, to be very honest with you, and I'm very blunt online, maybe not as blunt as, you know, Dr. Subbio, but I will sometimes comment on, and I'll say things, well, look, I don't think this result is frankly natural. If you're looking for a natural result, this is just not it. I'm just plain and simple like that. And a lot of people sometimes agree, sometimes disagree, it starts a discussion, but I would say most of the time when you go towards the extreme, it gets more and more negative. And that's what's important that patients see, is that there's also a negative impact on sometimes how other people can view you in real life, not in social media, but in real life.
Yep. And that comes back down to, I know, something we agree on because we talked about it last time, which is that really from a medical perspective, our goal would be to aid patients, collaborate with others. Essentially, the absolute kind of bottom rung of what we're supposed to be doing is enabling communication and collaboration. And the more extreme you get, the more people will effectively feel uncomfortable maybe you could use the word distrust. And that by distrust, I mean they don't know how to read this person because they don't look like a normal person. So it creates a little barrier to connection. Now, it may work very well within a sort of subculture that you reflect. You know, if you're, for example, take the, you know, like the goths, for example, they communicate being a goth to other goths, and that makes sense. But if you're not a goth, it slightly makes you feel like, I don't really know how to engage. Some people might feel that way. So it becomes a barrier to collaboration when you overdo it. That would be the very medical way of looking at it. The thing that I want to touch on aside from that is, so I've heard people describe it as edgy treatments. And I was thinking about this word edgy, and what do they mean they're on the edge of? And I think it might be like on the edge of beauty. It's like you're trying to be beautiful and have all these definition and proportion and volume in all right places, but you're taking it right to the edge, because at the edge, it's almost like some supermodels do look slightly unusual. They're slightly odd proportion-wise, and it gets your attention. And I wonder if there's something in these trends that are tapping into a human need for some sort of differentiation or some sort of communication of something that's similar but different.
Definitely. I think a lot of people sometimes want to fit in, but at the same time, there's also some people that want to be unique. You want to be the only person that maybe looks that way, right? You have a certain feature about you that makes you appealing to others. Yeah, I mm-hmm. definitely agree. I think there's a certain component to be different on the extremes of things, right? I mean, maybe extreme is not necessarily a good word, but on the edge, on the end of the spectrum of what can be considered normal. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a want for some of these treatments, to be very honest with you. And since a lot of these treatments are seen as relatively low risk, well, a lot of people are doing it, right? It seems appealing for sure.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing with being edgy is it's a very, by definition, there's a fine line between edgy and massive overtreatment, because you're right on the edge anyway. So as soon as you tip over, it's like you instantly generate more of those negative responses, which is what a good clinician should be first and foremost trying to avoid.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the other things we wanted to talk about a little bit was maybe some of the where these trends are coming from, right? That's actually a great question. And I feel as if a lot of these trends are coming from influencers, bloggers, makeup artists even as well. What you see on runway shows, you know, the next new Dior, Louis Vuitton show has a certain type of makeup that people are trying to emulate as well. I mean, there's a show, I think maybe it's on Netflix, I'm not quite sure, but Euphoria, and a lot of people are trying to do this sort of like Euphoria makeup with sparkles and glitters, and that at some point is also going to translate to medical aesthetics in some way. I mean, I think there's one that actually went into medical aesthetics is this, I don't know if you've seen this before, but the freckles, the ones where they're sort of tattooing the freckles on them, giving that sort of like sunned, as if they've been out in the sun type of thing, which I find quite interesting. What do you think about that one? I've always wondered.
Yeah, I've met a few people with that, and to my mind, I've never met one and thought, oh, she's got nice freckles. It's always a little bit more obvious that these are not real freckles, because I was talking to a hair transplant surgeon about how hard it is to make the front of your hairline look organic. It's very easy to make it look straight, no matter how hard they try. It's one of the hardest things, and it's a bit like that with freckles. Like, to make them look organic is pretty hard.
Sorry about that. There was a little phone call in the back. Hopefully, it didn't ruin the podcast there. But yeah, it's not easy to create these very natural, organic looking results, right? is just, to me, going back to it, it's just very important that people understand what they're getting into, right? These fractals, these freckles, they're essentially tattoos, right? These are things that you're going to probably keep on your face for quite a long time. I mean, thank God for, tattoo, laser tattoo removal. But if we didn't have some of these things could be quite permanent. I mean, you're stuck with it for life, you know?
Mm-hmm. And they change color as you get older as well. I've seen some that have kind of gone from brown to green, not the normal color for a freckle.
Really? Really? Yeah. My goodness. I honestly wonder how that happened. Maybe the UV sort of like changes the ink and how you see it under the skin. Yeah, actually quite interesting for sure.
I'm sure a good tattoo artist will have a way around that, but I've certainly seen some funny colored freckles in my time.
For sure. I mean, the other thing that goes more into medical aesthetics would be more like that pixie nose, right? Pixie nose, as we know it, is something that you see a lot in non-surgical nose jobs. You actually will see it also in surgical rhinoplasties as well. That sort of like Tinkerbell nose with that maybe lifted, but sometimes even overlifted tip. I did actually have a patient maybe 2 weeks ago that actually came in that had a non-surgical rhinoplasty done, and unfortunately they lifted her tip just a little bit too much by placing maybe a little bit too much filler right at the columella. And she didn't like that sort of piggy sort of snout nose that had sort of lifted her up a little bit just too much. So we just did a little bit of a correction, and she was very happy after that. But I mean, these are some things that, you know, there's some implication. That's another appointment. You have to go see another physician. You have to just solve it. So these are some things that you just have to keep in mind when asking for something, right? That's something mainly for patients to follow. But as an injector though, the other point of view is to sort of say, well, you have to be aware about these trends, right? It's very, very important to know about these trends. What can create a pixie nose, right? If you don't know that pixie nose can be done by surgical or non-surgical rhino, foxy eye with some threads. I mean, I think injectors need to be aware about the trends that are there, and also be informing their patients on the potential risk of it. The issue is that some of them are so new. Like they pop out in a week. Mm-hmm. You have to learn about it right away. I got a patient that came in one time asking for something that I haven't even heard before. At that point, I can't really do much besides say to the patient, well, you know what? Maybe see me next week. I'll do some research on it. That's the honest answer. I don't know too much about it. I mean, there's so many things on social media right now. It's sometimes hard to keep up, actually.
Yeah, I think it's a super important thing as well. I think the other element of these trends is what happens is you get a lot of people suddenly doing a new thing, and we actually don't understand how it works yet. So pixie nose is a great example, because a lot of patients end up with a red tip and even a necrotic injury from overpressurizing the tip of the nose, because you cannot do that on everyone. It's not, but if when you've only done three or four, you think it's about just keeping on injecting and trying to get more projection, and some noses simply don't move that way, and you end up putting so much in that you cause pressure. Similarly with what was the other one I was going to talk? So a lot of new treatments. I know when the whole so-called domino treatment, where you slide a cannula up here into the scalp and try and lift the lower face somehow, a lot of complications have come from that. I've seen Dr. Maria Landau has recently shared alopecia caused by pressure. No, it's not a necrotic injury, but it causes alopecia. She's done a study on that. And then I've seen three really awful scalp necrosis caused by that. And there was a sudden wave of it when it was out on social media. And I think it's important to remember, whenever you see something new on Instagram, that what you're not seeing are the side effects, the complications, the dissatisfaction that happens. And you can almost pick any fad, and they've all got elements to that. The other one I've seen is the pens, that, what do they call, hyaluron pens, when they're initially sold, they're zero side effects, zero bruises. And actually, when you see patients, they get bruises and side effects, just like they do with anything. But you only discover that once thousands of people are doing it. Yeah, so I think, well, there's a couple of things to be aware of, both as a clinician, but especially as a patient, is when the latest things come out, we don't actually understand the risk profile of those things, and you will not get the risk profile from social media, because in social media it's essentially propaganda. For most of the pages, the big pages that do very trendy treatments will only show you the good aspect of those treatments. Obviously,
exactly. Of course, I mean naturally, it's sort of like when I tell people when they go on social media, just looking at before and afters, I just tell them who's going to post a bad before and after in a way. You know what I mean? Like, they're going to post something that for them looks good, right? Always. And I think as a clinician, you have to sort of break it down and think, well, what am I actually truly doing here? Just like that sort of, you know, they call it the temporal litany. I think that's what you were sort of mentioning almost. Well, that technique, if you really think about it, could be quite dangerous. And you might not necessarily know the full extent of the risk until you actually do it, and maybe even take a look at some of the research that's out there and some of the complications that it can cause. It's so new. It's something that, you know, we've seen in the last 2-3 years, I would say. Like, this is not something that I've heard about when I first started, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. So clinicians need to break down, what are you exactly trying to achieve with it? What is the potential results that it can give? How much lift is it even going to give you? Is it worth the risk of putting a cannula up near the temple? You decide at that point, right? You decide as as an injector how risky that is, and if you have the skill set to be able to do it, right? Yeah. I think a lot of injectors are also sort of saying, well, look, I've seen this new technique. There's a research paper that's even published about it. I should probably try it because I read that paper and this is what it looks like it's doing. But I think you need to go a little bit deeper even before performing these sort of treatments, and maybe think about some risks that maybe some of the people that even published didn't even think about, because, you know, medical mm-hmm. aesthetics research is new. We don't have a huge amount of research that's out there. The patients, if you look at the studies and the populations, they're 10 patients, 20 patients, 30 patients. We're not talking about 100,000 or even 10,000 patients to even compare to really see what the risk is. So I think it's important to take a step back, think about it before doing it. I don't have anything wrong against it necessarily, but just take the time to assess it properly.
Yeah, I think it's very worth remembering that novelty or invention is disproportionately rewarded. Because it's new, it gets a ton of attention. But new does not mean fully understood. And as you say, the evidence base in medical aesthetics is by normal standards essentially non-existent. I often use the example of, we don't actually know that hyaluronidase prevents necrosis, because each VO is so nuanced and different that you don't know whether that was the deciding factor based on 5 studies or 10 or even 100. Like, you'd need a lot of very similar injuries on thousands of patients to actually prove that. But that's probably one of the more understood things, to understand whether, you know, for example, how long a fox eye lasts, or whether what the side effects and risks are, and what those patients think, whether they're actually happier in 6 months' time or not, is not really understood yet. So needs to be thought about carefully.
We know a lot of things short term. Unfortunately, long term, we just don't know. I mean, just give the example about the COVID vaccine, for example. When it just first came out, we didn't know the long-term effects. We probably still don't, actually, to be very honest with you. These are some sort of risks that some people have decided to take, essentially, saying that, well, you know what, the benefits are probably going to outweigh the risk related to doing it. So, yeah, very, very good point, Tim. Yeah, I think clinicians need to break it down before doing something.
And alongside that, unfortunately, the people who you get the first advice from are the people who are already marketing and selling it. So you're not getting an objective point of view, not to say that they're lying, but, you know, we're all human and we like the things that we're trying to promote to work, and you're more likely to speak about them in a more positive way. So it all needs a lot of interpretation, careful thought, and a degree of healthy skepticism.
Yeah, I think it's important to just ask some questions, right? And not just blindly follow a trend. That's for sure for a clinician.
Something else you mentioned as you're talking, you mentioned about the injector and how high profile injectors may get patients to do these things in a different way, because the way I understand is the patients are not always simply buying a result, they're buying a story as well of the person who treated them, and if they're a high profile person, then they feel like the result is worth a different amount. And to a degree that's correct, because it's harder to get someone who's very high profile to do something. But these big accounts that pop up that do very trendy things can produce a very high status and glitzy image, and then promote a novel treatment that's not very well understood, and get many patients to buy into that story before we actually know how the story ends.
The story is always very appealing in social media in general, right? If you create a story, people want to be a part of it. It's only normal mm-hmm. that people are going to grab attention and want to follow that story, or sometimes even be a part of that story. I feel as if a lot of the millennials, the Gen Zs, a lot of them not only want to have, well, I feel as if there's two sort of different types of patients that we see out there. We have a patient who is maybe a little bit more mature, a little bit older, that generally doesn't want to have their pictures posted online. You know, they don't want their before and afters posted online. But then you generally have this population maybe under the age of 40, under the age of 30, where they kind of want you to post online. They're like, where's my before and after that you posted on that other patient? Like, I want to have my picture on your page, right? I want to be on your Instagram page. And they want to be part of the story. They want to be feel like I had that treatment from that celeb doctor or that celeb page, or because you want to feel part of that group, right? And it's only understandable why some people want to essentially follow that. The issue is following it blindly, of course, and just getting everything just because everybody is getting it. I mean, that happens in the clothing trend. I mean, there's some certain clothing trends that sort of come and go as well. Everybody gets that same type of clothing, and then a couple years later, a couple months later, there's a switch to something else, something new, right? It's just that the long-term effects in medical aesthetics are just it's affecting your body at that point. It's just not the same thing as just putting on a different piece of clothing. There are some other things that you need to think about before doing these procedures. That's the difference. That's the difference between, you know, doing it and doing these changes and following these trends is the fact that it can actually affect your body. It can actually affect you in the long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a really important point to make to your patients is that although, you know, we've got nothing against trends per se or against, you know, brands and things that you want to communicate via other methods. But if you're trying to communicate your association with a brand or with a trend with something that's semi-irreversible and risky, then that doesn't fit well with what a good clinician should do, which is not take those risks for short-term aims. And I think it's what you're already doing with the way that you speak on social media, is that you're clearly laying the groundwork, that you're laying down the rules for how you like to operate. And that will not appeal to everyone, but you'll get the patients that you like treating because they already come to you for guidance rather than just to vend the latest treatment. And I think if I think about our audience in general, a lot of them, of course, are trying to grow practices. They're hungry. They want to develop. They want to grow their practice. And it's very tempting when you see someone getting a ton of attention for doing something, even if you don't believe it works or that it actually looks that good. It can be tempting to go down that route. And what I'd suggest they do instead is what you're doing, which is you can still talk about it. You can still be part of the trend, but you can be a voice that gives a different story on it. And patients will value that.
I think educational content is also very good. I mean, some social media users are just consuming content and liking everything, but there are some other social media users who are actually conscious and actually fully aware that there are some risks related to it. And those are the ones that are sometimes even contacting you. They're like, hey, this is the trend that I'm seeing. I know that there's risk about it. What do you think about it? Do you think that that's an actual valid risk? Is it even worth doing that treatment? So a lot of them actually sometimes do the research online. It might not be as deep as us clinicians when we take a look at it, but a lot of them do try and stay as informed as possible. So I don't think it's not a great idea ever as a clinician to necessarily fool your patients. I think just being honest with them, just being clear cut, setting your own boundaries is important when going forward, because if you don't do things that, or let's say you're not respecting your own ethics, your own personal aesthetic, and this is beyond, you know, medical professional ethics. But if it starts even affecting your own values, at some point it's going to affect you, and you're not going to be performing at the top level, because you're always going to have something in that sort of in the self-conscious at the back of your mind saying, well, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing anyways, right? And that's sort of going to eat at you. You don't want to be doing things.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. I think I have this realization in life in general and with my staff of trying to motivate them to do various things. Your body kind of knows when you're in the right place and you feel a certain way when you're doing the right thing. I mean, it's kind of a silly example, but I always think that way with meetings. If I see a member of staff who's in a meeting and they look bored, they probably don't need to be in that meeting because they'd be paying attention if it was. But it's a bit like that with a patient where you are feeling uncomfortable. You're kind of convincing yourself, maybe I should do it, maybe it's only a little bit, but your body's saying this is not, you don't really want to do it. Like, pay attention to that stuff because it helps you. It's a way of navigating about it.
It's like a spidey sense almost. You're just like, there's something off, you know what I mean? And especially clinicians, you know when it's off, you know what I mean? You're just like, this is probably something that you should just tread carefully before doing. That's all.
Yeah. There's some deep instinct about what your life's supposed to be about, and you're not doing it. So back out. So tell me about some of the other trends that you've seen that have made you kind of notice this situation. There was a couple I hadn't heard before.
Let me see here. I mean, a lot of them are sometimes related to medical aesthetics, but they're also in the sort of beauty industry. I've seen a lot of the face yoga these days. I think there a lot of it was with the gua sha, and then they had these face rollers as well, which I always thought quite interesting. But face yoga maybe is a little bit different, is because there's actually muscular contraction that's really related to it. Honestly, harmless, to be very honest with you, if you really think about it. I mean, what can necessarily go wrong unless you're doing it in a very intense way and you're damaging your tissues and creating some bruising? I don't see it. It seems relatively harmless, to be quite honest with you. It's just I sometimes question the benefit or the evidence on, you know, if it's actually going to do anything for you. The theory behind it makes sense, right? I mean, there's lymphatic drainage. You're stimulating your muscles that are helping for the lifting effect. So it can certainly have a certain amount of effect, but I'm sure you have to do a lot of it to actually see some long lasting effects for you. Certainly not dangerous in my opinion, but I don't know. So that's another one that I've been seeing. I've been seeing a lot of I call it do-it-yourself beauty hacks. Just random random videos on TikTok or on Instagram of people mixing homemade things, salt with lemon and things like that, applying it on their skin as if it's good for your skin. But you know, there's already a lot of dermatologists. I don't necessarily need to mention it more, but there's already a lot of dermatologists like calling out some of these do-it-yourself like hacks that people are posting online. People are even trying that out on themselves, but I mean, you know, they're getting into some severe reactions sometimes, and you're seeing it online, some overblown angioedema all over the face. So just got to be careful of what you're doing before doing it. Maybe do a little patch test on your skin before doing a do-it-yourself. A lot of these do-it-yourselves are, on it, to be very honest with you, based on not much. You know, somebody had a thought that this ingredient can help with this, and then they're mixing another ingredient that helps with that. So together should probably do this. I think the logic is there. It's just that what you see in real practice and what's actually delivered is not what you get. That's the only thing. So I just find them sometimes curious, sometimes a little interesting. I think some patients definitely see through them. Don't get me wrong. Like, I don't think every single patient is just going to look at it and be like, oh, I might as well put lemon on my face and, you know, my wrinkles are going to be gone, or just drink two liters of olive oil. I don't think that they're necessarily going to believe it. It's become a meme at that point, you know? Mm-hmm. So some patients are definitely see through these trends. Some don't though. And I feel the younger patients are a little bit more influenceable in some of these things. And that's where you can get in a little bit more danger.
Mm-hmm. Have you come across mewing?
Mewing? No, I have not. No, yeah. What is that?
So this is an idea that you can change the way your bone structure develops by pushing your tongue against the back of your teeth, so to speak. And it's worth Googling, but it's very interesting because some clinicians, I think even Andrew Huberman, mewing, M-E-W-I-N-G.
Wow. There's before and afters too. Impressive.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I mean, it's very interesting, but there's various things that clash with how I feel like things work. I'm intrigued by it because, you know, Professor Andrew Huberman, I think it was a Dr. Andrew Huberman, but, you know, big podcast. He's done a whole podcast on it. I'm intrigued by how much of it is natural facial development, because a lot of it's kind of masculinization of faces, like the chin growing. And if you're
the
a man,
jaw, the chin.
Age 16, yeah,
exactly,
you start doing this mewing, but then you age 5 years between the ages of 16 and you know, 21, your jaw grows a lot. So, you know, I can look back at myself when I was 16 and I had a small underdeveloped jaw, and it's developed. So I wasn't mewing.
Look at you now, all chiseled.
Yeah. People always say it's filler. It's actually not.
You know what? I get the same thing. Maybe it's because we work in medical aesthetics. Everybody thinks like my jawline's not, and it's natural, guys.
Yeah, mewing is an interesting one because it's kind of an alternative therapy. But then there are these other interesting things. Like you mentioned something to do with hair growth as well. What was that one I saw pop up?
Hair growth? I mean, I think I mentioned
eyelashes.
So there's this brow lamination. That's a new thing that's actually quite interesting. I personally think it looks quite good, to be quite honest with you, the brow lamination. But that's my personal look about it. So brow lamination is a trend that involves shaping the eyebrows in sort of like a brushed up and like a feathery sort of style, which honestly, it looks pretty good, to be quite honest with you. And from a distance, it doesn't really, you can't really see it. It's mainly from really up close, you can sort of see that sort of feathery look. I believe those are, I think those are like sort of like tattoos, almost like microblading, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I definitely see. But the hair, no, I didn't. Did you see something related to the hair?
So I think that was it I was thinking about. But the interesting thing with brows, brows are extremely fashion based, and you know most women will happily look back at pictures of themselves from the, you know, Miranda's done this as well. You share a picture of yourself on social media, and yeah, back in the noughties, probably when you were too young to notice, but it was my wife had very thin eyebrows, and then they became this other trend of very thick eyebrows, and you know, and then it's tattooed eyebrows, and there's always people at the extremes where, I mean, this is not a human face looks like, nor ever has, but it's fashionable. And I think it's a good example of something that can look odd and different if you're not part of that culture, but also isn't body dysmorphia. Because one of the things I think happens too often is people label anyone who looks different or odd to their mind as having body dysmorphia, and it's really not what body dysmorphia is. I think a lot of people have fashionable treatments that look odd, guaranteed, but but it's not because they're dysmorphic. They're just in a trend or a fashion element that we're not aware of because we're not part of it.
Mm-hmm. That's something that's, you have to also be careful of labeling somebody as body dysmorphic as well when they're just looking for maybe a more eccentric look. But body dysmorphia is more your reaction to how you look being uncomfortable as well, and never being satisfied of the way you're appearing. So that's important to make that distinction, and not labeling patients as having a certain type of disease in a way, and more of just they're trying to be looking eccentric. Like, give an example, if somebody has dyeing their hair, are you necessarily going to call them body dysmorphic? No, not necessarily. Maybe they just decided to dye their hair a different color, right? I think we label a lot of people's as well. And we put them into certain categories. And I think it's important to have a conversation with the patient and assess their goals related to the treatment, so you can even see if it's body dysmorphia or just somebody trying to look eccentric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's always, I think curiosity is a great way to go into these things as opposed to judgment. Just be curious, understand it. You still say no when you're unsure, like you've already touched on that kind of, I'm saying no because of where my limit of my understanding ends, rather than because I think you're a crazy person. Because you know, it actually comes from Star Trek. I don't know if this will be interesting to our audience, probably not. But you know, the Star Trek has the Prime Directive, and the Prime Directive is this idea that you never mess with the development of another civilization, and not to say that they didn't ever do this, but they would essentially have this philosophy that they're going to make mistakes, and we're not going to be involved with those mistakes, but we'll also think it might actually, in the end, lead to something better. So that's the idea that, you know, I won't inject your face. I won't judge you for wanting to have it injected. I won't play a role in it. And you assume that they'll learn as they go on to understand things better. They may make mistakes on the way, but you don't want to be involved in the mistakes. I think that's a kind of balanced way of putting it.
I mean, preventing is the easiest way to go here. I think that, well, thankfully in medical aesthetics and non-surgical treatments, a lot of them are reversible, thankfully, right? So you can somewhat correct them. I think a lot of, sometimes some pages even use that as sort of like another reason why they should get some of these treatments, in the sense where, hey, look, they're reversible. Mm. If you don't like it, you know, I mean, just get rid of it type of thing, as if it's simple and easy. But I think you just have to tread carefully, especially when certain treatments are surgical. But and the reason why I say surgical, I have nothing against necessary surgeries, but it's just because they're less reversible. And that's all. When you go mm-hmm. through that type of procedure, you're looking for something more long term. And I think it's important to, before doing something long term, is just to think about it like 2, 3, even 4 times. And I think I think a lot of patients already do. Is just that sometimes with the huge amount of people following social media, there's always going to be more and more people who are going to feel or do less and less research before doing a certain type of procedure that is more and more popular. That's all, right? The more you get exposed to these sort of things, the more complications that we're going to be getting related to them. It's only natural, I feel like. It's just that we're trying to limit them as healthcare practitioners to protect our patients in a way, but also for us, in the sense where as an injector who wants to be ethical, you want to be able to inject and feel comfortable while injecting as well, and that you're not creating A, overblown results, but B, you're not going to risk that your uncomfortable risk because somebody is sort of like holding your hand and sort of like pushing you to do that treatment. At the end of the day, you're the one with the needle at the same time, right? So there's a certain type of control that you do have over as well, right? There's never a situation where a patient is going to force you to do it. You're never forced to actually do it as a clinician. You can always respectfully say no. There's better ways of saying it, of course, but you can always say no to a certain type of treatment if you don't believe that it's going to be good for them.
Yeah, I think the key is to take some time to try and offer some guidance rather than just say no. I think then you can do some good on the way out of the door, if you know what I mean. You can. And sometimes it's hard. It's actually easier not to do this in many cases. I remember having a patient many years ago who was, you know, she was a let's say a matriarchal personality. She was not used to being told what to do by a young man at the time, and so it was a 50-minute discussion. And you know, I probably taught her everything I knew about shape and proportion and details and all that stuff. And she was really hard to get to admit that she shouldn't have that treatment. She was adamant that it was the best thing for her, and that's why, you know, because I try hard not to. My personality is naturally non-confrontational, and that kind of helps me find a way of saying no that's on their side. But it was hard because some patients are very adamant. And of course, the other issue you have is younger patients who will get a quick no, but they just go and find somewhere else. And I feel like that's a lost opportunity to at least try and give them a respectful, detailed description of why you won't do it.
At the same time, I've also had patients who I've clearly explained my thoughts on the trend, respectfully, you know, offering maybe some other treatments that probably would suit them a little bit better compared to it. And some of them actually gained the trust from you explaining your thoughts on those trends. It just means that as a clinician, as a patient, you're thinking to yourself, well, oh, this clinician has thought about the trend. He's aware about the trend at least. So he's in the field. He knows about it. And he's even explaining to me some of the potential risks related to it. He just doesn't believe that it's worthwhile. Sometimes it actually gives some of my patients more confidence in me, and they come back doing some other treatments as well. So I see it as not necessarily a negative thing or a good thing when somebody comes in with a demand of following a necessary trend. It's actually maybe possibly could be seen as an opportunity to just educate your patient. It's a great opportunity, actually. And that opportunity to express that, and the better you're able to express it, the more trust that patient is going to get into you. And look, they may go to another clinic, they may go see somebody else, but they may also refer you another patient when you'd be like, hey, you know what, this doctor seems like he knows what he's doing there. So I think gaining that trust is the main thing that you want from your patients, because the moment you gain that trust, well, then you have a more open conversation on some of the treatments that they want and some of the treatments that you might think that is also good for them. So I think that trust aspect is also very important for your patients. I mean, that's how I built my practice.
Absolutely. I think that's a great take home, because I had to figure this out obviously over time myself, but patients come seeking a result, but what they really value is a guide. So if when they ask for the result, you then immediately start guiding them, it's for many of them, it's an amazing experience. They're like, wow, they don't realize how much you can understand and how many different options there are and what can go right and wrong. And when they find someone who does that, even though they weren't looking for it, it becomes more valuable than the injections themselves, to find someone you can trust. So it's not something you should be afraid of. I think it's easy when you're a new injector to think you need to please your patient, but it's much better to guide them and actually say no to certain things, because they actually value that more. Now, I often think it's funny that clinicians will imply that saying no to treatments is costing them money. I think it's the best way to build a loyal clientele is to say no. Exactly. It's not a bad business move.
Definitely. It's a great business move, actually. It's a great business move. I had patients where they came in, consulted, thinking they're going to get a treatment. I said, no, I don't think it necessarily, well, maybe I didn't say it just like that, but I respectfully said, this is my opinion on it and not doing the treatment. And a lot of them come back for other things as well, where they refer me some patients as well. So it's not, saying no is honestly not a bad thing at all, for even on a business sense. I think it's a great thing as well. It really cements you as somebody who is comfortable with their techniques, and B, somebody who has set their boundaries as well. And that's important. You don't want to be a people pleaser in medical aesthetics. I'll say that right away. You're going to get into so much more trouble if you say yes to everybody. That's for sure.
Yeah, I think that is a Absolutely. Like one of the most important things that you take from this, because it often feels easier in the short term, but you just build up a debt in the long term where you pay the price for not saying what you really think and not putting the boundaries down that you believe in.
Prevention is still number one. Prevention and educating is still the most important thing. And I think sometimes if you spend enough time for your consultation with the patient, you'll be able to figure things out. The problem is sometimes when you have a fully run clinic is you're spending less time sometimes with the consultation. But that's probably especially for a new patient coming in, spend that time. That amount of time is actually very valuable. An extra 5-10 minutes you can learn a lot about a patient and learn about the reasons why they even want to do that treatment. The why is so important, I feel like. The why you're getting that treatment.
So that I'll share something which I got from a friend of mine, Dr. Kevin, at House of Ikigai. That's his business. He told me ages ago that you can't do that kind of thing. You can't actually get into the realm of finding out why unless you unconsciously have a good opinion of people, of your patient. If you think that the average person, if you get to the bottom of all things, is broken, why would you ask questions? You have to believe that they are after something good, but they don't understand how to get there. And that's exactly the right position to put yourself as a guide, which is, I believe you're asked for something that's worth attaining, but you might be asking for the wrong thing. So let's dig into why you're here, what you're trying to attain, and then I'll see if I can help you get there. Mindset.
Definitely. But that shift makes the whole difference. I think, and I highly encourage every single injector, new and old, who hasn't done this before, is start adding into your regular questionnaire. You're in your consultation. Is like, hey, why are you here? Because you want to get that treatment, sure, but go just want that one step further. Why do you want that treatment? I think that's just going to open a whole realm of medical aesthetics that you just haven't seen before. The patient's going to, you're going to be a lot more open to your patients. Your patient's going to be a lot more open to you, and you're going to understand the real reason why they're there. They might even tell you a personal story. They might even tell you a personal story of why they're getting that treatment. It might be, and sometimes if you don't ask it, you won't know. But if you do ask it, you'll really realize that very often, patients are going to say, I was walking down the street and somebody made a comment about it. Or I was at a family birthday party and some child went up to me. Because children have no filter sometimes, right? They'll just say whatever that's on their mind. So it's very often that you'll see, why does mommy look like that? Or why does auntie this look like that, right? So these are things that I see quite often. And a lot of the times it makes medical aesthetics as well way less superficial than it actually is if you understand the real reasoning why some of these patients are doing their treatments.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. So, and that's probably most important if it's something you don't understand, like if you don't understand why they're asking for it. And a trend is a good example. Why is someone coming in and asking, doesn't matter what it is, like they may be asking for a vertical lip treatment because they've seen it on a video, or they may be asking for Russian lips or, you know, pixie nose. Like, what's the real underlying reason? And you may discover that it's totally inappropriate treatment, and they're just looking for something to stand out. And then you can, once you know what that is, you can then consult them on something that actually make them more beautiful. Because there's something also that's helped me is helping people realize that although they want their lips to be beautiful, they don't want that to be the main feature. You know, you want to be a beautiful girl, not the girl with the big lips. I often say that to patients, and then that's a way that they think, yeah, you're right. My real goal is not to stand out because of my lips. My goal is to be more attractive. And then you've got an anchor to redo the consultation from the start with a goal to be more attractive instead of have Russian lips. And it takes usually like 35 seconds and you've got a new goal.
Exactly. It just shifts the way that you're sort of looking at it, and it makes it so that you're looking at the whole picture rather than just focusing on one thing at the same time. Now, maybe I'm going to add that tip to my arsenal as well, Tim. Thanks.
Is there, because you also mentioned in the some of the texts we've got around culture, equity, diversity type, like, do you think there's a drive amongst patients to look like different, to fit different cultural norms that you've seen in your practice?
Oh, now we're delving into maybe like some cultural appropriation at that point. But I mean, the same argument could be said if somebody goes to the source or goes to the Jamaica and gets their dreads, right? That's a classic sort of thing. I mean, look, to be very honest with you, I don't have that many patients who are coming to consult me looking to us and wanting to look a different type of ethnic group or cultural group. I'm just going to be very honest. There's not that many patients. A lot of them want to still fit in their cultural and ethnic group. It's just that I had noticed that, and they had mentioned this a couple of times, is that some people had seen that when a trend goes out, sometimes that trend is it looks appealing, but it might take up features of a certain type of ethnic group, right? Nothing wrong with that in a sense. Maybe it's a good thing in the sense where you're saying that that particular feature in that ethnic group is a very good looking thing, but that feature for that ethnic group may look good on that ethnic face, may not look good on your face though. That's the difference there. So that's what I explain to my patients. It says that, I mean, I'll give an example of the Asian face because you mean look at me. But if you take a look at an Asian face, for example, and you take one feature and you sort of like transpose it on somebody else's face, it may not actually look that good. And Asian faces are actually quite difficult to inject. And if you do have some Asian patients, you might know this due to our sort of cheek and our facial structure is a little bit different there. But there are certain things in certain types of faces where you're just like, you know what, that is a Asian nose right there. You know what I mean? There are certain types of features that really make you ethnic and cultural. And I don't think it's necessarily a wrong thing. I don't think it's ethically wrong to want to look a certain type of way if it makes you feel beautiful. I just don't necessarily think that transposing certain things from one ethnic group to another is the right move to make aesthetically. Now, risk wise, that may be a whole other conversation. But culturally, I don't think I don't see anything necessarily too wrong about it. They're actually trying to celebrate it. I don't think it comes from a place of you know racism or negativity. I think it comes from a place of positivity. I'm saying, oh, you have a certain type of feature that you have that I don't have that looks appealing and nice. I want to try and have it as well. You know what I mean? So also, but in the way you display it as well is also very different, right? But I just don't think that I have a lot of patients who are coming in asking to look at completely different, like a different cultural group. Have you had patients who have asked that?
Interestingly, I was told this was the goal behind many of my Chinese patients. So you'd say, someone would say, oh, they want to look more Western. And then I started to get lots of Chinese patients and that basically was never the case. So because I don't know, it's probably a white person who told me that they try. So you're having these consultations and there were elements that you could, if you're trying to communicate something aesthetically that's complex, they might say more like round eyes, more like a Western person. They might say that. But if you do something, the interesting one I came across was an eyebrow lift. And if you do an eyebrow lift on a Chinese face, the word from my patient was don't do that because it makes us look strict. So she saw that as looking stern, and it's more typical to have a straighter eyebrow, which suits the feminine Chinese face. And that was just one of many examples where I realized that it was much more complex than trying to look a certain way. They had an idea of beauty, which some of which overlapped with some of what Western faces were like, but some of it was a purely Chinese idea of beauty. And there was definitely not a unifying goal of make me look Western. That was never the case. It's something I think a lot of people tell stories from their perspective that makes sense, but they're not actually the person doing it. Another example, I think, is this idea that the patriarchy is behind women seeking beauty, because never in my life have I had a patient come and say, I'm having this treatment so that men will like me. But there's no woman who has ever come in and said, I'm trying to please men. So I don't know where the idea comes from that it's a patriarchy. Maybe it's a matriarchy, but more often it's just an individual who's got a particular goal. And it's certainly not, I don't think it's for women, it's about pleasing men. I think men are actually quite easy to please in many ways, but
extremely easy. I mean, I think it's on even on the other end of the spectrum. I think it just empowers women, to be quite honest with you. You know, it gives them the right to have control over. I mean, I don't want to necessarily get into that whole conversation, like my body and everything like that. But when you have your own body, in my perspective, though, this is my personal perspective, is that it empowers women to make the decisions on what they want in their lives, right? And it also includes medical aesthetics. That's it. So I think it could actually empower some women. It's just that there are certain boundaries that you have to respect. There's certain ethical standards that you have to respect as a clinician. And one of the examples that I wanted to touch up on, and I'm sure you've heard about this recently, was that there was one plastic surgeon in the U.S. that essentially lost her license from, you know, social media, from posting some TikTok videos. I don't know the exact details related to it, but it's definitely related to the fact that she was posting like surgeries of her patients, and they had some complications as well. So there are certain risks to social media. Social media is great. I love it. We use it. You use it. Miranda uses it. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, the amount of information that you can get online is quite amazing. But the issue of it is that not all of the information online is portrayed in a very clear and objective manner. It's very often subjective and appealing and very packaged very nicely for you, right? You gotta see social media as a marketing monster at this point. It's marketing. It's online marketing, if you think about it. It's no longer the, I'm posting a picture of, you know, my hot dog that I ate for lunch. You know, Instagram has honestly become a marketing platform, and people need to be aware about that as well.
I think that's probably a great place to finish up, which is what you get on Instagram is a slither of the truth, a carefully collated, comments deleted, one moment in time from one angle that looks good, and that's the tip of the iceberg of the full story. So when you see a new trend come out, just be aware that what you're seeing is not a consistent result for every patient with no side effects, no complications, and no negative results. It's never that. A good saying I always say to my patients as well is there are no effects without side effects. There are no interventions that don't have bad outcomes associated with them, or they're not really interventions. And so we have to go into these new ideas. I mean, I remember literally seeing adverts for the Hyaluron pen saying no bruising, no side effects. Like, that was the ad for it. It was like, how can you say that? Like, wow. It's just factually untrue.
That's why blatant. Yeah, exactly. It's blatant sometimes, right? And actually, interesting, that Hyaluron pen is completely banned in Canada. I mean, even Health Canada published a full, you can even Google it right now, Health Canada Hyaluron pens completely banned for the last couple of years due to the complications and people being misinformed. So yeah, in Canada, we're quite strict on a lot of these. We're quite strict on a lot of these things. Thankfully, they stay relatively up to date on a lot of them. You know, they'll miss the ball in a lot of things, but at the same time, like in terms of if you look at all the countries in the world, Canada is actually quite regulated compared to, sorry to say this, but the UK, like you guys are completely unregulated. That is still insane in my opinion, but that's my opinion. That might be a whole topic for another time.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's the land of opportunity. You can be 15 years old, book on a course.
100%. I don't think it's necessarily anything wrong that beauticians are doing it. I think that you just have to be very safe with it, right? There's just some risks related to it. That's all. So great. It was an amazing conversation thing, Tim. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. Was there anything else that you wanted to delve in?
No, I think we've done a really thorough job.
For sure.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to talk with you again, and I'm sure we'll talk again, especially if you start your own podcast, which I'm now going to say that you're thinking about doing, so that'd be cool.
Yes, I am. I mean, you see the lighting is all set up, so there you go.
Great. It's a pleasure talking to you, Alex, and hopefully speak to you again soon.
Always a pleasure. Have a good one, Tim.